Why worry about something if you can't do anything about it?
Now you're starting to sound like Belgarath. He tends to shrug things off and trust his luck sometimes. I like things a little neater.
He stared off into the darkness.
Stay close to Paul tonight, little girl, he said after a moment. Don't get separated from her. It might take you someplace you hadn't planned to go. But you're supposed to stay with her, no matter what.
What does that mean?
I don't know what it means, he retorted irritably. All I know is that you and she and the blacksmith and that stray child you picked up are supposed to stay together. Something unexpected is going to happen.
You mean a disaster? We must warn the others.
We don't know that it's a disaster. That's the whole problem. It might be necessary, and if it is, we don't want to tamper with it. I think we've about run this discussion into the ground. Go find Palgra. Stay with her.
Yes, Belden,
Tenedra said meekly.
As the stars began to come out, the anchors were raised and the Kerak fleet began to slip quietly downriver toward Tol Mardu. Though they were still some miles above the city, commands were issued in hoarse whispers, and the men all took great care to avoid making noise as they shifted their weapons and equipment, tightening belts, giving their armor quick last-minute checks, and settling their helmets more firmly on their heads. Amidships, Relg was leading his Ulgos in a quiet religious service, muttering the harsh gutturals of the Ulgo tongue in a scarcely audible murmur. Their pale faces had been smeared with soot, and they looked like so many shadows as they knelt in prayer to their strange god.
They are the key to this whole thing, Rodar observed quietly to Palgara as he watched the devotions of the Ulgos. Are you sure that Relg is all right for this? Sometimes he seems a bit unstable.
He'll be fine, Palgara replied. The Ulgos have even more reason to hate Torak than you Aelons do.
The drifting ships slowly rounded a wide bend in the river, and there, a half-mile downstream, stood the walled city of Tol Mardu, rising from its island in the middle of the river. There were a few torches atop the walls, and a faint glow rising from within. Barak turned, and shielding it with his body, he briefly uncovered a muffled lantern, letting out a single flicker of light. The anchors sank very slowly through the dark waters toward the river bottom, with a very faint creak of ropes. The ships slowed, then stopped. Somewhere inside the city a dog began to bark excitedly. Then a door banged open, and the barking cut off suddenly with a yelp of pain.
"I don't have much use for a man who kicks his own dog," Barak muttered.
Relg and his men moved very quietly to the rail and began to clamber down the ropes into the small boats waiting below. Tenedra watched breathlessly, straining with her eyes to see into the darkness. The very faint starlight briefly showed her several shadows drifting down toward the city. Then the shadows were gone. Behind them there was a faint splash of an oar, followed by an angrily hissed admonition. The princess turned and saw a moving tide of small boats coming down river from the anchored fleet. The spearhead of the assault slid silently by, following Relg and his Ulgos toward the fortified island city of the Tulls.
"Are you sure there are enough of them?" Anheg whispered to Rodar.
The rotund king of Drasnia nodded.
"All they have to do is secure a landing place for us, and hold the gate once the Ulgos get it open. There is enough of them for that," he murmured.
A faint night breeze rippled the surface of the river, setting the ship to rocking. Unable to bear the suspense any longer, Tenedra lifted her fingertips to the amulet Geryon had given her so many months before. As always, a buzz of conversation filled her ears.
"Yagator kohak vilta."
It was Relg's harsh voice, speaking in a whisper.
"Katak, vid."
"Well?"
Palgara asked, one eyebrow slightly raised.
I cannot tell what they are saying,
Tenedra replied helplessly.
They're talking in Ulgo.
A strangled groan quite suddenly seemed to come from the amulet itself, and then was quickly and horribly cut off.
I think they just killed somebody,
Tenedra said in a quavering voice.
It started then,
Anhig said with a certain grim satisfaction. Tenedra pulled her fingertips from the amulet. She could no longer bear to listen to the sound of men dying in the dark. They waited. Then someone screamed, a scream filled with a terrible agony.
That's it, Barak declared. That's the signal. Pull the anchor,
he shouted to his men. Very suddenly, beneath the high dark walls of Tulmardu, two separate fires flared up, and shadowy figures could be seen moving about them. At the same moment, there was a clanking rattle of heavy chains inside the city, and a creaking groan as a broad gate swung ponderously down to form a bridge across the narrow north channel of the river.
"Man your oars!"
Barak roared to his crew. He swung his tiller hard over, steering toward the rapidly lowering bridge. More torches appeared along the tops of the walls, and there were shouts of alarm. Somewhere, an iron bell began to clang a note of desperate urgency.
"It worked,"
Anhig exclaimed, gleefully pounding Rodar on the back.
"It actually worked." "Of course it worked,"
Rodar replied, his voice also jubilant.
"Don't pound on me so hard, Anhig. I bruise easily."
All need for silence was gone now, and with a great roar, the massed fleet followed in Barak's wake. Torches flared, and the faces of the troops lining the rails were bathed in their ruddy glow. A great splash suddenly erupted from the river 20 yards to the right of Barak's ship, showering everyone on deck with a deluge of water.
"Catapult!"
Barak shouted, pointing at the walls looming ahead. Like a huge praying insect, the heavy-beamed frame of the siege engine balanced atop the wall, its long throwing arm already cocking back to cast another boulder at the approaching fleet. Then the arm stopped as a storm of arrows swept the top of the wall clean. A crowd of Drasnians, easily identifiable by the long pikes they carried, overran the position.
"Watch out down there!"
One of them roared into the confusion at the base of the wall, and the siege engine ponderously toppled outward and fell with a crash to the rocks below. There was a thunder of hooves across the now lowered bridge, and the Membrate Knights crashed into the city.
"As soon as we tie up to the bridge, I want you and the princess and the other ladies to go to the north bank,"
King Rodar said tersely to Palgara.
"Get back out of harm's way. This will probably take the rest of the night, and there is no point in exposing any of you to the accidents that could happen."
"Very well, Rodar," Polgara agreed. "And don't you do anything foolish either. You are a rather large target, you know."
"It'll be all right, Polgara. But I'm not going to miss this."
He laughed then, a strangely boyish laugh.
"I have not had so much fun in years," he declared.
Polgara gave him a quick look.
"Men,"
she said in a tone that said everything. A guard of Membrate Knights escorted the ladies and Erend perhaps 1,000 yards upstream to an indented cove on the north bank of the stream, well away from the press of the horsemen rushing toward the beleaguered city. The cove had a gently sloping sand beach and was protected on three sides by steep, grass-covered banks. Durnik the smith and Olban quickly raised a tent for them, built a small fire, and then climbed up the bank to watch the attack.
"It's going according to plan,"
Durnik reported from his vantage point.
"The Karak ships are lining up side by side across the south channel. Soon as they get the planking in place, the troops on the other side will be able to cross."
"Can you tell if the men inside have taken the south gate yet?"
Olban demanded, peering toward the city.
"Oh, I can't tell for sure," Durnik replied. "There's fighting going on that part of the city, though."
"I'd give anything to be there,"
Olban lamented.
"You stay right where you are, young man,"
Bolgara told him firmly.
"You appointed yourself bodyguard to the Riven Queen, and you are not going to go running off just because things are more interesting someplace else."
"Yes, Lady Bolgara,"
the young Raven answered, suddenly abashed. It's just...
Just what? I wish I knew what was happening, that's all. My father and my brothers are in the middle of the fighting, and I have to stand here and watch.
A sudden great belch of flame shot up from inside the walls to illuminate the river with sooty red light. Bolgara sighed.
Why do they always have to burn things? She asked sadly.
It adds to the confusion, I suppose,
Durnick replied.
Perhaps, Bolgara said. But I have seen this happen too many times before. It is always the same. There always has to be a fire. I don't believe I care to watch any more of this.
She turned her back on the burning city and walked slowly away from the river bank. The night was interminable. Toward dawn, as the stars began to fade from the paling sky, the Princess Tenedra, drawn with fatigue, stood atop a grassy bank near the cove, watching with a kind of sick fascination as the city of Tolmardo died. Entire districts seemed to be in flames, and great fountains of orange sparks belched toward the sky as roofs caved in and buildings collapsed. What had seemed so stirring, so glorious in her anticipation, had turned out to be something quite different in reality, and she was sick at what she had done. She still, nonetheless, brought her fingertips up to touch the amulet at her throat. She had to know what was happening. No matter how horrible the events were in the city, not knowing what was happening was even worse.
"Sort of a nice little fight,"
she heard King Unheg say. The king of Kerak seemed to be someplace very high, atop the walls of the city, perhaps.
Pretty routine,
Barak, Earl of Trelham, replied.
The Murgle garrison fought pretty well, but the Tulls kept falling all over themselves trying to surrender.
What did you do with all of them?
King Kohag asked.
We herded them into the central square,
Barak answered.
They've been amusing themselves by killing the Grolems we flushed out of the temple.
Unheg suddenly chuckled an evil sort of sound.
How is Grodeg?
It looks like he's going to live.
That's a shame. When I saw that axe sticking out of his back, I thought somebody had solved one of my problems for me.
It was too low,
Barak said rather mournfully.
It broke his spine, but it didn't hit anything else significant. He won't be walking anymore, but he's still breathing.
You can't depend on a Murgo to do anything right, Unheg said in disgust.
They did thin out the bear cult pretty thoroughly,
Barak noted cheerfully.
I don't think there are more than 2 dozen of them left. They fought pretty well, though.
That's what they are here for. How long do you think it will be before daylight?
30 minutes, maybe.
Where is Rodar?
He and Folrak are sacking the warehouses.
The Murgos had some supply dumps here,
King Kohag replied.
Folrak wants to confiscate them.
He would,
Anheg said.
Maybe we had better send somebody for him. It's getting on toward the time when we'll want to think about pulling out of here. As soon as it gets light, all of this smoke is going to announce what we have done to anyone within 20 leagues. It's about time to start the fleet moving. It's a long march back to the forts on top of the escarpment.
How long will it take you to get to the Sea of the East?
Kohag asked.
A couple of days, Unheg told him. You can move a ship pretty fast when you have got the current behind you. It will take your army a week at least to get back to the forts, won't it?
Probably,
Kohag said.
The infantry cannot move all that fast. There's Brindig. I will send him to fetch Rodar.
He shouted down to the Sindar.
Conall Brindig, see if you can find Rodar. Ask him to join us.
What's that?
Barak asked suddenly.
What's what?
I thought I saw something out there, way to the south, where you can just start to make out that hilltop.
I don't see anything.
It was just a flicker. Something moving.
Probably a Murgos scout creeping in for a look. Anhig laughed shortly then. I don't imagine that we'll be able to keep what happened here a secret for very long.
There it is again. I saw it that time too, King Kohag agreed.
There was a long silence as the sky imperceptibly grew lighter. Sinetra held her breath.
Belvar,
Anhig swore in a stunned voice. They stretch for miles.
Leldoran,
Barak shouted down from the wall.
Brendig's gone to get Rodar. Go find them. Tell them to get up here at once. The plain to the south is covered with Murgos.
Chapter 16.
Lady Bulgara,
Tinedra cried, jerking back the flap of the tent.
Lady Bulgara!
What is it, Sinetra?
Polgara's voice came from the darkness inside the tent.
Barak and Anhig are up on the walls of the city,
the princess said in a frightened voice.
They just saw a Murgo army coming up from the south.
Polgara came quickly out into the firelight, holding the sleepy errand by the hand.
Where is Beldin?
She demanded.
I have not seen him since early last night.
Polgara raised her face and closed her eyes. A moment or so later there was a rushing sound of wings, and the large hawk settled to the sand not far from the flickering fire. Beldin was swearing sulfurously, even as he shimmered and blurred back into his natural shape.
How did they slip past you, uncle?
Polgara asked him.
There are Grolems with them, he growled, still sizzling the air around him with oaths. And the Grolems could feel me watching. So the troops moved only at night, and the Grolems shielded them.
Where did they hide in the daytime?
Well, in the Tullish villages, apparently. There are dozens of communities out there. Never occurred to me to pay all that much attention to them.
He began to swear again, berating himself savagely for having missed the movement of the Murgo army.
Well, there's no point in swearing about it now, uncle,
Polgara told him coolly. It's done.
Unfortunately, there's a bit more, Paul, the sorcerer told her. There's another army, at least as big, coming in from the north. Malorians, Nadraks, and Tulls. We're caught right between them.
How long have we got before they reach us?
Polgara asked.
Beldin shrugged.
Not long. The Murgos have some rough ground to cross, probably about an hour. The Malorians will be here in quite a bit less.
Polgara began to curse fervently under her breath.
Go to Rodar, she told the hunchback. Tell him that we have to release Anhig's fleet immediately, before the Angraks can bring up catapults and destroy the ships where they are anchored.
The deformed man nodded and stooped slightly, curving his arms out like wings even as he began to waver and change.
Olben,
Polgara called to the young Riven, go find Sir Mandor Allen and Lord Hetar. Send them to me at once. Now hurry. Olben gave her one startled look, then ran for his horse. Durnick, the smith, came sliding down the grassy bank onto the little beach. His face was grave.
You and the ladies must leave at once, Mistress Paul. There's going to be fighting here. In the middle of a battle's no place for any of you.
I am not going anywhere, Durnick, she replied with a trace of irritation. I started all this, and I'm going to see it through.
Arianna had gone back into the tent as soon as the situation became clear to her. She now emerged again, carrying the stout canvas bag in which she kept her medical supplies.
"Have I thy permission to leave, Lady Polgara?"
she asked, with a certain cool professionalism.
"In battle, men are injured, and I must make preparations for their care. This spot is somewhat too remote and confined to receive the wounded."
Polgara gave her a quick look.
"All right," she agreed. "Just be careful not to get too close to the fighting."
Taiba pulled on her cloak.
"I'll go with you,"
she told Arianna.
I don't know that much about it, but you can teach me as we go along.
Go help them get set up, Durnick, Polgara told the smith. Then come back here. Durnick nodded gravely and helped the two women up the steep bank. Mandorallan thundered up on his charger with Hetar at his side. "You know what has happened?" Bolgara demanded. Mandorallan nodded. "Is there any possibility of withdrawing before the enemy forces arrive?"
"Nay, Molly de Pogra," the great knight replied. "They are too close. Moreover, our purpose has ever been to gain passage for the ships of Kerik into the Sea of the East. We must buy them time to sail beyond the reach of the siege engines of the Angarax."
"I didn't want this," Pogra said angrily, and she began to mutter curses again. Brand, the gray-cloaked Raven Warder, accompanied by General Varana, rode up to join Mandorallan and Hetar at the top of the steep bank. The four of them dismounted and slid down the bank to the sand.
"We've begun evacuating the city," the big Raven said in his deep voice, "and most of the fleet is pulling anchor. We're holding just enough ships to maintain the bridges across the South Channel."
"Is there any possibility of putting the entire army on one bank or the other?" Polgara asked him. He shook his head.
"There isn't time, Polgara."
"We're going to be divided by the river, then," she pointed out. "And neither force is going to be strong enough to meet the Angarax coming against it?"
"A tactical necessity, my dear Lady Polgara," General Varana told her. "We have to hold both banks until the fleet is clear."
"I think Rodar misjudged the Angarak intentions," Brand said. "He was so sure that Tarogos and Zakath would both want to avoid taking casualties that he did not consider this a possibility."
General Varana clasped his muscular hands behind his back and limped back and forth along the little beach, his face creased in thought.
"I think I began to understand the meaning of that Murgo column we destroyed in the uplands," he said.
"Your grace?" Mandorallan asked, puzzled.
"It was a test of our commitment," Varana explained. "The Angarax needed to know, when we were making our major move, one of the basic rules of war is not to become involved in serious conflicts if what you are doing is merely diversionary. That column was bait. Unfortunately, we took it."
"You mean that we should not have attacked the column?"
Varana made a rueful face, answering Hetar.
"Apparently not. It gave away our intentions. It let them know that this expedition was not a diversion. I underestimated Tarogas. He threw away 1,000 men just to find out what we are up to."
"What now, then?"
Hetar asked.
"We get ready to fight," Varana said. "I wish we had better terrain for it, but I suppose that we will have to make do with what we have."
Hetar looked out across the river, his hawk face hungry.
"I wonder if I have got time to make it over to the south bank," he mused.
"One side or the other," Brand said, looking puzzled. "What is the difference?"
"The Murgos are over there,"
Hetar replied.
"I don't really have anything against Malorians."
"This is not a personal fight, Lord Hetar," Varana pointed out.
"It is with me,"
Hetar said grimly.
"We must needs see to the safety of Lady Polgra and the Princess," Mandorallan said. "Mayhap an escort should be provided to convey them back to the forts atop the escarpment."
Brand shook his head.
"The region's likely to be patrolled heavily. It would not be safe."
"He is right, Mandorallan," Polgara told the knight. "Besides, you need every man you have got right here." She looked off toward the northeast. "Then, too, there is that." She pointed toward a heavy cloud bank that had begun to stain the sky just above the horizon. The clouds were an inky black, seething and roiling, and illuminated from within by fitful flickers of lightning.
"A storm?" General Varana asked, looking a bit surprised.
not at this time of year, and certainly not from that direction, Bolgara replied. The Grolems are up to something, and that is going to be my fight. Deploy your forces, gentlemen. If there is going to be a battle, let's be ready for it.
The ships are moving, Durnick reported as he and Ulban came back to the sheltered little cove. And the troops are leaving the city. King Rodar rode up. His broad face was streaked with soot and perspiration.
Unheg's leaving, he said, swinging down from his saddle with a grunt.
Where's Fulrak? Brand asked.
He's taking the bulk of the troops across to the south bank.
Isn't that going to leave us a little undermanned on this side?
General Varana inquired politely.
That bridge is too narrow, Rodar told him. It would take hours to bring enough men across to make any difference. Brentig's already got a crew undermining the supports so that we can bring the bridge down before the Angraks get here.
What for?
Tinedra asked him.
Tulmardus, too good a vantage point, Your Highness, General Varana explained. We don't want any Angraks on the island, if we can help it.
He looked at King Rodar.
Have you given any thought to tactics?
We want to give Unheg half a day, if possible, Rodar replied. The ground along the river gets marshy about 20 leagues downstream, and the Angraks won't be able to get close enough to pester him once he gets that far. Let's form up a conventional infantry line, pikemen, the legions, sindars, and so on. We will put the archers in support and use the algas to slash at the flanks. I want to hold the Mimbrate knights in reserve until the Malorians mass up for their first charge.
That is not a winning tactic, if your majesty will forgive my saying so,
General Varana answered.
We are not here to win, Varana. We are here to delay the Angraks for about 6 hours, and then withdraw. I'm not going to waste lives trying to win a battle that I have not any chance of winning.
He turned to Hetar.
I want you to send a force of your clansmen on a sweep down river. Tell them to uproot any Malorians they find emplaced along the riverbank. The significance of the fleet still may have escaped Zakath and Tar Urgas. Angraks are not good sailors, so they probably don't realize what Unheg can do once he gets into the seas of the east.
Excuse me, Your Majesty, Varana objected, but all of your strategy, even the fleet, is merely a delaying action.
That is the whole point, Varana, Rodar told him bluntly. All of this is really rather insignificant. What's really important is going to happen in Meloria when Belgarion reaches Tal Mishrak. We had better move, gentlemen. The Malorians will be here before long, and we want to be ready for them.
The cloud bank, Polgara had pointed out, was sweeping toward them with an alarming speed, a seething darkness of rolling purple, stalking forward on crooked legs of lightning. A hot wind seemed to flee out ahead of it, flattening the grass and whipping the manes and tails of the horses wildly. As King Rodar and the others moved out to meet the approaching Malorian army, Polgara, her face pale and her hair tossing behind her in the wind, climbed the grassy bank with Tenedra and Durnick behind her, and stood watching the approach of the cloud.
Take the child, Tenedra. Don't let go of him, no matter what happens.
Yes, Lady Polgara,
Tenedra said, holding out her arms to Erand. The child came to her immediately, his serious little face unafraid. She picked him up and held him close, her cheek against his.
Erand,
he said, pointing at the approaching storm. Then, among the ranks of their army, shadowy figures rose up out of the ground. The figures wore black robes and polished steel masks, and carried cruel, pointed short spears. Without pausing to even think, a mounted young Mimbrate knight swept his broadsword from its scabbard and swung the whistling blade at one of the steel-masked figures. His sword passed through the figure with no effect. As he struck, however, a sizzling bolt of lightning struck him, seeming to attach itself to the point of his helmet. He stiffened convulsively
as the lightning, like a writhing snake of intense light, clung to the tip of his steel helm. Smoke boiled out of the slits of his visor as he roasted inside the armor. His horse lurched forward onto its knees while the ghastly, flickering light engulfed them both. Then the lightning was gone, and horse and man collapsed, stone dead. Polgara hissed and raised her voice. She did not seem to be speaking that loudly, but the effect of her words reached the farthest edges of the army. "Do not touch the shadows," she warned. "They are Grolem illusions, and cannot hurt you unless you touch them. They are here to draw the lightning to you, so stay clear of them."
"But Mistress Paul," Durnick protested, "the troops won't be able to hold ranks if they have to keep dodging the shadows."
"I will take care of the shadows," she replied grimly. She raised both arms above her head, her fists clenched. A look of dreadful concentration filled her face, and then she spoke a single word, opening her hands as she did so. The grass, which had been bending toward them in the hot wind, preceding the storm, suddenly flattened in the opposite direction as the force of Polgara's will rippled outward. As that force passed over each shadowy Grolem illusion, the figures seemed to flinch, then shrivel, and then with silent detonations each shadow exploded into shards and fragments of darkness. Polgara was gasping as the last of the shadows on the farthest edge of the army vanished, and she would have collapsed had Durnick not jumped to her side to support her.
"Are you all right?" he asked worriedly.
"Just give me a moment," she said, wilting against him. "That took a great deal of effort."
She smiled at him, a wan little smile, and then her head drooped wearily.
"Won't they come back?" Zinedra demanded. "What I mean is, it didn't actually hurt the real Grolems, did it? Just their shadows?"
Polgara laughed weakly.
"Oh, it hurt them all right," she replied. "Those Grolems don't have shadows anymore. Not one of them will ever cast a shadow again."
"Not ever?"
the princess gasped.
"Not ever."
Then Belden joined them, swooping in with the wind tearing at his feathers.
"Now we've got work to do, Polgara," he growled, even as he shimmered into his natural shape. "We're going to have to break up this storm they're bringing in from the west. I talked with the twins. They'll work on the southern side of it. You and I will have to take this side."
She looked at him inquiringly.
"Their army's going to be advancing right behind the storm. There's no point in trying to hold it back now. It's got too much momentum. What we want to do is to break open the rear edge of it and let it spill back over the Angorax."
"How many Grolems are working on the storm, Uncle?"
"Oh, who knows?" he shrugged. "But it's taking every bit of effort they can muster just to keep it under control. If the four of us hit the backside all at once, the pressures in the storm itself will do the rest."
"Well, why not just let it pass over, then?" Durnick said. "Our troops aren't children. They won't fall apart just because of a little squall."
"This isn't just a little squall, Blacksmith." Something large and white thudded to the ground a few feet away. "If you get four or five of those hailstones on top of the head, you won't care how the battle turns out."
"Well, they're as big as hinge eggs," Durnick said in astonishment.
"And they'll probably get bigger."
Belden turned back to Polgara then.
"Give me your hand. I'll pass the signal to Beltira, and we'll all strike at the same time. Now get ready."
More of the hailstones thudded into the springy turf, and one particularly large one shattered into a thousand fragments as it crashed down on a large rock with stunning force. From the direction of the army came an intermittent banging as the hailstones bounced off the armor of the membrane knights or clanged down on the hastily raised shields of the infantry. Then, mixed with the hail, the rain squalls struck. Seething sheets of water driven before the wind like raging waves. It was impossible to see, and almost impossible to breathe. Alban jumped forward with his shield raised to protect Zinedra and Erend. He winced as a large hailstone struck his shoulder, but his shield arm did not waver.
It's breaking, Paul, Belden shouted. Let's push it once more. Let them eat their own storm for a while.
Polgara's face twisted into an agony of concentration, and then she half slumped as she and Belden unleashed their combined wills at the rolling sky. The sound of it was beyond belief as the vast forces collided. The sky ripped suddenly apart, and lightning staggered and lurched through the smoking air. Great incandescent bolts crashed into each other high above, showering the earth beneath with fireballs. Men fell, charred instantly into black, steaming husks in the driving downpour. But the casualties were not only among the men of the West. The vast storm, with its intolerable pressures, recoiled as the combined wills of Polgara and Belden on the north bank and the twins on the south bank ripped open the back edge of it, and the advancing Malorians received that recoil full in the teeth. A curtain of lightning swept back across their close-packed ranks like an enormous blinding broom, littering the earth with their smoking dead. As the fabric of Grolem sorcery, which had driven the storm front toward the river, ripped apart, the gale winds suddenly reversed and flowed back, shrieking and howling, confounding the advancing Angoraks with rain and hail. From out of the center of the dreadful cloud overhead, swirling fingers of murky black twitched and reached down toward the earth with hideous roaring sounds. With a last, almost convulsive jerk, one of those huge, swirling funnels touched the earth in the midst of the red-clad Malorians. Debris sprayed up and out from the point of the dreadful vortex, as with ponderous immensity it cut an erratic course 200 yards wide directly through the enemy ranks. Men and horses were ripped to pieces by the insane winds within the swirling column of cloud, and bits of armor and shreds of red tunic, and, worse, showered down on the stunned and terrified Malorians on either side of the swath of absolute destruction moving inexorably through their midst. "Beautiful!" Belden exulted, hopping up and down in a grotesque display of glee. There was the sudden sound of a great horn, and the close-packed ranks of Drasnian pikemen and Tolnedran legionaries facing the faltering ranks of the Malorians opened. From behind them, his armor streaming water, Mandorallan led the charge of the Mimbrate knights. Full upon the confused and demoralized Malorians they fell, and the sound of the impact as they struck was a terrible rending crash, punctuated by screams. Rank upon rank was crushed beneath the charge, and the terrified Malorians wavered, then broke and fled. Even as they ran, the clans of Algar swept in among them from the flanks, their sabers flashing in the rain. At a second blast of Mandorallan's horn, the charging Mimbrates reined in, wheeled, and galloped back, leaving a vast wreckage behind them. The rain slackened fitfully. Little more than errantly passing showers now and then, and patches of blue appeared among the racing clouds overhead. The Grolem storm had broken and dispersed back across the plains of Mishrachachtul. Tinedra looked toward the south bank and saw that the storm there had also dispersed, and that the forces under the command of King Kohag and King Coradulan were assaulting the front ranks of the demoralized Murgo army. Then the princess looked sharply at the south channel of the river. The last bridges of Kerik ships had broken loose during the violent storm, and there was now only open water on that side of the island. The last troops remaining in the city were streaming across the bridge over the north channel. A tall Sindarian lad was among the last to cross. As soon as he reached the bank, he came immediately upriver. As he drew nearer, Tinedra recognized him. It was Rundurig, Geryon's boyhood friend from Faldor's farm, and he was openly weeping.
"Good Medanic," he sobbed as he reached them. "Dorun's dead."
"What did you say?"
Lady Polgara demanded, raising her tired face suddenly.
"It's Dorun, Mistress Paul," Rundurig wept. "He drowned. We were crossing over to the south bank when the storm broke the ropes holding the ships. Dorun fell into the river. He didn't know how to swim. I tried to save him, but he went under before I could reach him."
The tall young man buried his face in his hands. Polgara's face went absolutely white, and her eyes filled with sudden tears.
"Take care of him, Durnick,"
she told the smith, then turned and walked away, her head bowed in grief.
"I tried, Durnick,"
Runderig blurted, still sobbing.
"I really tried to reach him, but there were too many people in my way. I couldn't get to him in time. I saw him go under, and then there was nothing I could do."
Durnick's face was very grave as he put his arm about the weeping boy's shoulders. The smith's eyes were also filled, and he said nothing. Tenedra, however, could not weep. She had reached out her hand and plucked these unwarlike young men from their homes and dragged them halfway across the world. And now, one of Geryon's oldest friends had died in the chill waters of the River Mardu, his death on her head. But she could not weep. A terrible fury suddenly filled her. She turned to Ulban.
"Kill them,"
she hissed from between clenched teeth.
"My queen?"
Ulban gaped at her.
"Go," she commanded. "Take your sword and go. Kill as many Angraks as you can. For me, Ulban. Kill them for me."
Only then could she weep. Ulban looked first at the sobbing little princess and then at the milling ranks of the Malorians, still reeling from the savagery of the Mimbrate assault. His face grew exultant as he drew his sword. "As my queen commands," he shouted, and ran to his horse. Even as the decimated front ranks of the Malorians fled, harried by the saber-wielding Algars, greater and greater numbers of their countrymen reached the field, and soon the low hills to the north were covered with them. Their red tunics made it look almost as if the earth itself were bleeding. It was not the Malorians, however, who mounted the next attack. Instead, thick-bodied Tulls in mud-colored smocks marched reluctantly into position. Directly behind the Tulls, mounted Malorians urged them on with whips. Beldon growled.
"Basic Malorian strategy. Sir Kath wants to let the Tulls do most of the dying. Oh, he'll try to save his own troops for the campaign against Tar Urgas."
Tenedra raised her tear-streaked face.
"What do we do now?"
she asked the misshapen sorcerer.
"We kill Tulls," he said bluntly. "A charge or two by the Mimbrates ought to break their spirits. Tulls don't make very good soldiers. They'll run away as soon as we give them the chance."
Even as the sluggish forces of Mishrachachtul flowed like a mudslide downhill toward the solid line of pikemen and legionnaires, the Asturian archers, just to the rear of the infantry, raised their bows and filled the air with a solid arcing sheet of yard-long arrows. The Tulls quailed as rank after rank melted under the withering storm of arrows. The shouts of the Malorians at the rear became more desperate, and the crack of their whips filled the air. And then Mandor Allan's horn sounded. The ranks of infantry opened, and the armored knights of Mimbre charged again. The Tulls took one look at the steel-clad men and horses crashing toward them, and immediately bolted. The Malorian whipmen were swarmed under and trampled in the panic-stricken flight of the Tull army.
"So much for the Tulls,"
Beldon grunted with satisfaction as he watched the rout. He grinned an evil grin.
"I imagine that Zakath's going to speak firmly to King Gethel about this."
Mandor Allan's knights thundered back to their positions behind the infantry, and the two armies glared at each other across a field littered with Angrak dead. Tenedra began to shiver as a sudden chill swept the battlefield. Although the sun had broken through the ragged clouds as the Grolem storm rapidly dispersed, there was no warmth to it. Even though all trace of wind had died, it grew colder. Then, from the ground, and from the dark surface of the river, tendrils of fog began to rise. Beldon hissed.
"Polvera," he snapped to the grieving sorceress. "I need you."
"Leave me alone, uncle,"
she replied in a voice still choked with sorrow.
"You can cry later," he told her harshly. The Grolems are drawing the heat out of the air. If we don't stir up a wind, the fog's going to get so thick you'll be able to walk on it.
She turned, and her face was very cold. You don't respect anything, do you?
Not much. But that's beside the point. If the Grolems can build up a good fog bank, we'll have the whole stinking Malorian army on top of us before we can even see them coming. Let's go, Paul. People get killed. It happens. You can get sentimental about it later.
He held out his gnarled, lumpy hand to her. The tendrils of fog had begun to thicken, lying in little pockets now. The littered battlefield in front of the infantry lines seemed to waver, and then disappeared entirely as the fog congealed into a solid wall of white.
Wind, Paul, Belden said, taking hold of her hand. As much wind as you can raise.
The struggle which ensued then was a silent one. Polgara and Belden, their hands joined together, gathered in their wills and then reached out with them, probing, searching for some weakness in the mass of dead calm air that imprisoned the thickened fog along the banks of the river. Fitful little gusts of breeze swirled the eddying fog, then died as quickly as they had arisen.
"Harder, Paul," Belden urged.
His ugly face streamed with rivulets of sweat as he struggled with the vast inertness of unmoving air. "It's not going to work this way, Uncle," she declared, pulling her hand free. Her face showed her own strain. "There's nothing to get hold of. What are the twins doing?"
"The hierarchs of Rakhtal are riding with Tarugas,"
the hunchback replied.
"The twins have their hands full dealing with them. They won't be able to help."
Polgara straightened then, steeling herself. "We are trying to work too close," she said. "Every time we start a little local breeze, a dozen Grolems jump in and smother it."
"All right," Belden agreed.
"We will have to reach out further," she continued. "Start the air moving somewhere out beyond their range, so that by the time it gets here it has too much momentum. They won't be able to stop it." Belden's eyes narrowed.
"That's dangerous, Paul," he told her. "Even if we can do it, it's going to exhaust the both of us. If they throw anything else at us, we won't have any strength left to fight them."
"It is a gamble, Uncle," she admitted. "But the Grolems are stubborn. They will try to protect this fog bank, even after all chance of maintaining it has gone. They'll get tired, and maybe they'll be too tired to try anything else."
"I don't like maybes."
"Have you got a better idea?"
Not right now, no."
"All right, then." They joined hands again. It took, it seemed, to the princess an eternity. With her heart in her throat, she stared at the two of them as they stood with their hands joined and their eyes closed, reaching out with their minds toward the hot, barren uplands to the west, trying with all of their strength to pull that heated air down into the broad valley of the River Madhu. All around her, Tenedra seemed to feel the oppressive chill of Grolem thought, lying heavily on the stagnant air, holding it, resisting all effort to dissipate the choking fog. Polgara was breathing in short gasps, her chest heaving, and her face twisted with an inhuman striving. Belden, his knotted shoulders hunched forward, struggled like a man attempting to lift a mountain. And then Tenedra caught the faintest scent of dust and dry, sun-parched grass. It was only momentary, and she thought at first that she had just imagined it. Then it came again, stronger this time, and the fog eddied sluggishly. But once more that faint scent died, and with it the breath of air that had carried it. Polgara groaned then, an almost strangled sound, and the fog began to swirl. The wet grass at Senedra's feet, drenched with droplets of mist, bent slightly, and the dusty smell of the Tullish uplands grew stronger. It seemed that the blanket of concentration that had held the fog motionless became more desperate as the Grolems fought to stop the quickening breeze pouring down the valley from the arid stretches to the west. The blanket began to tatter and fall apart as the weaker of the Grolems, pushed beyond their capacity, collapsed in exhaustion. The breeze grew even stronger. It became a hot wind that rippled the surface of the river. The grass bent before it,
and the fog began to seethe, like some vast living thing, writhing at the touch of the arid wind. Tenedra could see the still-burning city of Tolmardu, and the infantry lines drawn up on the plain beside the river. The hot, dusty wind blew stronger, and the fog, as insubstantial as the thought that had raised it from the earth, dissolved, and the morning sun broke through to bathe the field in golden light.
"Polgara!"
Durnik cried in sudden alarm. Tenedra whirled in time to see Polgara, her face drained deathly white, slowly toppling to the earth. Chapter 17. Laldoran of Wildentor had been nervously pacing back and forth along the ranks of his bowmen, stopping often to listen for any sound coming out of the fog from the field lying in front of the massed infantry.
"Can you hear anything?"
he asked urgently of a Tolnedran legionnaire standing nearby. The Tolnedran shook his head. That same whisper came out of the fog from a dozen different places.
"Can you hear anything? Can you hear anything? What are they doing, then?"
Somewhere to the front there was a faint click.
"There!"
everyone cried, almost in unison.
"Not yet!"
Laldoran snapped to one of his countrymen who was raising his bow.
"It could be just a wounded Tull out there. Save your arrows."
"Is that a breeze?"
a Drasnian pikeman asked.
"Please, Baelor, let it be a breeze."
Laldoran stared into the fog, nervously fingering his bowstring. And then he felt a faint touch of air on his cheek.
"A breeze,"
someone exulted.
"A breeze,"
the phrase raced through the massed army. Then the faint breath of air died, and the fog settled again, seeming thicker than ever. Someone groaned bitterly. The fog stirred then and began to eddy sluggishly.
It was a breeze.
Laldoran held his breath. The fog began to move, flowing gray over the ground like water.
"There's something moving out there," a Tolnedran barked.
"Oh, get ready."
The flowing fog moved faster, thinning, melting in the hot, dusty breeze blowing down the valley. Laldoran strained his eyes to the front. There were moving shapes out there, no more than 70 paces from the infantry. Then, as if all of its stubborn resistance had broken at once, the fog shimmered and dissolved, and the sun broke through. The entire field before them was filled with Malorians. Their stealthy forward pace froze momentarily as they flinched in the sudden light of the sun.
"Now!"
Laldoran shouted, raising his bow. Behind him, his archers with one universal motion followed his action, and the sudden release of 1,000 bowstrings all at once was like some vast thrumming note. A whistling sheet of arrows soared over the heads of the solidly standing infantry. It seemed to hang motionless in the air for a moment, then hurtled into the close-packed Malorian ranks. The creeping attack of the Malorians did not waver or falter, it simply dissolved. With a vast, sighing groan, entire regiments fell in their tracks under the Astorian arrow storm. Laldoran's hand flickered to the forest of arrows thrust point first into the turf at his feet. He smoothly knocked another shaft, drew, and released. And then again, and again, and again. The sheet of arrows overhead was like some great slithering bridge, arcing over the infantry and riddling the Malorians as it fell among them. The storm of Astorian arrows crept inexorably across the field, and the Malorian dead piled up in windrows as if some enormous scythe had passed through their entire ranks. And then Sir Mandorallan's brazen horn sounded its mighty challenge. The ranks of archers and infantry opened, and the earth shook beneath the thunder of the charge of the Mimbrate knights. Demoralized by the arrow storm and the sight of that inexorable charge descending upon them, the Malorians broke and fled. Laughing delightedly, Laldoran's cousin Torresin lowered his bow to jeer at the backs of the routed Angoraks.
"We did it, Laldoran!"
he shouted, still laughing.
"We broke their backs!"
He was half-turned now, not facing the littered field. His bow was in his hands. His dark hair was thrown back, and his face reflected his exultant delight. Laldoran would always remember him so.
Dor, look out!
Lodoran shouted. But it was too late. The Malorian answer to the Asturian arrow storm was a storm of their own. From 100 catapults concealed behind the low hills to the north, a great cloud of rocks hurtled into the air and crashed down into the close-packed ranks along the riverbank. A stone, perhaps somewhat larger than a man's head, struck Torrison full in the chest, smashing him to the ground.
Tor!
Lodoran's cry was anguished as he ran to his stricken cousin. Torrison's eyes were closed, and blood was flowing from his nose. His chest was crushed.
Help me!
Lodoran cried to a group of serfs standing nearby. The serfs obediently moved to assist him, but their eyes, speaking louder than any words, said that Torrison was already dead. Morak's face was bleak as he stood at the tiller of his big ship. His oarsmen stroked to the beat of a muffled drum, and the ship raced downriver. King Unheg of Kerak lounged against the rail. He had pulled off his helmet so that the cool river air could blow the stink of smoke out of his hair. His coarse-featured face was as grim as his cousin's.
"What do you think the chances are?"
"Not very good,"
Barak replied bluntly.
"We never counted on the Murgos and Malorians hitting us at Tel Mardu. The army is split in two by the river. Both halves of it are outnumbered. They're going to have a bad time of it, I'm afraid."
He glanced over his shoulder at the half-dozen small, narrow-beamed boats trailing in the wake of his big ship.
"Close it up,"
he bellowed at the men in the smaller boats.
"Malorians ahead, on the north bank," the lookout at the mast shouted down to them. "About a half mile."
"Wet down the decks,"
Barak ordered. The sailors tossed buckets on long ropes over the side, hauled up water, and soaked the wooden decks.
"Signal the ships behind us,"
Anheg told the bearded sailor standing in the very stern of the ship. The sailor nodded, turned, and lifted a large flag attached to a long pole. He began to wave it vigorously at the ships strung out behind him.
"Be careful with that fire,"
Barak shouted to the men clustered around a raised platform filled with gravel and covered with glowing coals.
"If you set us ablaze, you'll all have to swim to the Sea of the East."
Just to the front of the platform stood three heavy-limbed catapults, cocked and ready. King Unheg squinted ahead at the Malorians gathered around a dozen or so siege engines, standing solidly on the north bank.
"Better send in your arrow boats now,"
he suggested. Barak grunted and waved his arm in a broad, chopping motion to the six narrow boats in his wake. In answer, the lean little boats leaped ahead, cutting through the water. Mounted at the prow of each arrow boat stood a long-armed catapult armed with a loosely packed bundle of arrows. Aided by the current, the narrow little boats sped past, their oars bending.
"Load the engines,"
Barak roared to the men around the gravel-based fire.
"And don't slop any of that tar on my decks."
With long iron hooks, the sailors lifted three large earthenware pots out of the coals. The pots contained a seething mixture of tar, pitch, and naphtha. They were quickly dipped in tar barrels and then hastily wrapped in naphtha-soaked rags. Then they were placed in the baskets of the waiting engines. As the arrow boats, speeding like greyhounds, swept in close to shore where the Malorians struggled to aim their catapults, the arrow bundles were suddenly hurled high into the air by the lashing arms of the Kerak engines. The arrows rose swiftly, then slowed at the top of their arcing flight, separating and spreading out as they flew. Then, in a deadly rain, they fell upon the red-tunicked Malorians. Barak's ship, trailing just behind the arrow boats, ran in close to the brush-covered riverbank, and the red-bearded man stood with both of his big hands on the tiller, staring intently at his catapult master, a gray-bearded old sailor with arms like oak stumps. The catapult master was squinting at a line of notches chipped into the railing in front of his engines. Over his head he held a long white baton, and he indicated direction by pointing it either to the right or to the left. Barak moved his tiller delicately in response to the movements of the baton. When the baton cut sharply straight down, and Barak locked his tiller in an iron grip, The rags wrapped around the pots leaped into flame as they were touched by waiting torches.
"Shoot!"
the catapult master barked. With a thudding crash, the beams lashed forward, hurling the flaming pots and their deadly contents in a high arc toward the struggling Malorians and their siege engines. The pots burst open upon impact, spraying fire in front of them. The Malorian catapults were engulfed in flames.
"Good shooting,"
Anhig noted professionally.
"Child's play," Varak shrugged. "A shoreline emplacement isn't much of a challenge, really."
He glanced back. The aeroboats of Greldik's ship were sweeping in to rake the Malorians with more arrows, and the catapults on his bearded friend's decks were cocked and loaded.
"Malorians don't appear to be any brighter than Murgos. Did it not ever occur to them that we might shoot back?"
"It is an Angrak failing," Anheg replied. "It shows up in all of their writings. Torak never encouraged creative thinking."
Barak gave his cousin a speculative look.
"You know what I think, Anheg? I think that all that fuss you raised back at Reva about Synedra leading the army, I think it was not entirely sincere. You're too intelligent to be so stubborn about something that wasn't that important."
Anheg winked broadly.
"No wonder they call you Anheg the Sly," Barak chuckled. "What was it all about?"
"It pulled Brand's teeth," the King of Kerak grinned. "He's the one who could have stopped Synedra cold, if I had given him the chance. Rivens are very conservative, Barak. I sided with Brand and did all of the talking. Then when I gave in, he didn't have any ground left to stand on."
"You were very convincing, I thought, for a while that your reason had slipped."
"Thank you," the Kerak King replied with a mock bow. "When you've got a face like mine, it's easy for people to think the worst about you. I found that useful from time to time. Here come the Algars."
He pointed at the hills just behind the burning Malorian siege engines. A great crowd of horsemen came surging over the hilltops to sweep down like a wolf pack upon the confounded Malorians. Anheg sighed then.
"I'd like to know what's happening to them back there at Tol Mardu. I don't suppose that we will ever find out, though."
"Not very likely,"
Barak agreed.
"We'll all get sunk eventually, once we get out into the Sea of the East."
"We'll take a lot of Malorians with us, though, won't we, Barak?"
Barak's reply was an evil grin.
"I don't really care much for the notion of drowning, though," Anheg said, making a face.
"Maybe you'll get lucky and catch an arrow in the belly."
"Thanks,"
Anheg said sourly. An hour or so later, after three more Angrak positions on the riverbanks had been destroyed, the land along the River Mardu turned marshy, flattening out into a sea of reeds and bending cattails. At Anheg's orders, a raft piled high with firewood was moored to a dead snag and set aflame. Once the blaze was going well, buckets of greenish crystals were hurled into the flames. A thick pillar of green smoke began to climb into the blue sky.
"I hope Rodar can see that," the King of Kerak frowned.
"If he can't, the Algars will. They'll get word back to him,"
Barak replied. "I just hope he's got enough time left to make his retreat."
"Me too. But as you say, we will probably never know."
King Kohag, chief of the clan chiefs of Elgaria, sat his horse beside King Coradulin of Arindia. The fog was nearly gone now, and only a filmy haze remained. Not far away, the twin sorcerers, Beltira and Belkira, exhausted by their efforts, sat side by side on the ground, their heads bowed and their chests heaving. Kohag shuddered inwardly at the thought of what might have happened if the two saintly old men had not been there. The hideous illusions of the Grolems that had risen from the earth just before the storm struck terror in the hearts of the bravest warriors. Then the storm, its intensity deafening, had smashed down on the army, and after that had come the choking fog. The two sweet-faced sorcerers, however, had met and overcome each Grolem attack with calm determination. Now, the Murgos were coming, and it was time for steel instead of sorcery.
"Hey, let them get a little closer,"
Quahog advised in his quiet voice, as he and Corradulan watched the veritable sea of Murgos advancing against the emplaced ranks of Drasnian pikemen and Tolnedran legionnaires.
"Art thou sure of thy strategy, Quahog?" the young Erendish king asked with a worried frown. "It has ever been the custom of the Knights of Mimbre to meet an attack head-on. Thy proposal to charge the flanks puzzles me."
"It will kill more Murgos, Corradulan,"
Quahog replied, shifting his weak legs in their stirrups.
"When your knights charge in from either flank, you will cut off whole regiments of the enemy. Then we can grind the ones who have been cut off up against the infantry."
"It is passing strange to me to work thus with foot troops,"
Corradulan confessed.
"I have a vast ignorance of unmounted combat."
"You are not alone, my friend,"
Quahog told him.
"It is as alien to me as it is to you. It would be unfair of us, though, not to let the foot troops have a few Murgos, would it not? They did walk a long way, after all."
The king of Arindia considered that gravely. He was quite obviously incapable of anything remotely resembling humor.
"I had not considered that," he confessed. "It would be selfish in the extreme of us to deny them some part in the battle. I must agree with you. How many Murgos dost thou think would be their fair portion?"
"Oh, I don't know,"
Quahog replied with a straight face.
"A few thousand or so, I imagine. We would not want to appear stingy. But it doesn't do to be over-generous, either."
Corradulan sighed.
"Ah, it is difficult to walk this line, King Quahog. This fine division between parsimony and foolish prodigality."
"One of the prices of kingship, Corradulan."
"Very true, Quahog, very true."
The young king of Arindia sighed again, and bent all of his concentration to the problem of how many of the advancing Murgos he could really afford to give away.
"Thinkest thou that two Murgos apiece might content those who fight afoot?" he asked rather hesitantly.
"Oh, that sounds more than fair to me."
Corradulan smiled then with happy relief.
"Well, then that is what we shall allot them. I have not divided up Murgos before, but it is not nearly so difficult as I had imagined."
King Quahog began to laugh. Lady Eriana put her arms about Lalderan's shaking shoulders and drew him gently away from the pallet upon which his cousin's body lay.
"Can you not do something, Eriana?"
he pleaded, tears streaming down his face.
"Perhaps a bandage of some sort, a poultice." "He is beyond my art, my lord,"
Eriana replied gently.
"And I share thy sorrow at his death." "Oh, don't say that word, Eriana. Torresen cannot be dead." "I am sorry, my lord. He is gone, and none of my remedies nor skill can bring him back to you." "Polgora can do it,"
Lalderan declared suddenly, an impossible hope leaping into his eyes.
"Send for Polgora." "I have no one to send, my lord,"
Eriana told him, looking around the makeshift tent where she and Tyba and a few others were caring for the wounded.
"The injured men here command all of my attention and care." "I will go then,"
Lalderan declared, his eyes still streaming tears. He spun then and dashed from the tent. Eriana sighed mournfully and drew a blanket over Torreson's pale face. Then she turned back to the wounded men who were being carried in a steady stream into her tent.
"Don't bother yourself with him, my lady,"
a lean-faced Arendish serf told her as she bent over the body of the man's companion. Eriana looked at the thin serf inquiringly.
"He's dead,"
the serf explained.
"He took a Malorian arrow right through the chest."
He looked down at the dead man's face.
Oh, poor Detton, he sighed. He died in my arms.